response you would get back in the file and for the court to look at. So I think it is a policy question whether that is going to be good enough for a court to decide whether effective service was made.
Are there any other bills in the subcommittee which that issue strikes me as one that maybe the subcommittee ought to think out a little bit more? Representative Smith, I'm wondering if you'd have any objection if we have another vehicle in the subcommittee that maybe we take that up as a perhaps still further amendment.
2888, unfortunately, offers a vehicle that's got a wrong relating clause. We do have Representative Otto's bill, service on the wrong person, which right now would be a problem with the relating clause.
Why don't we take 2888, go back to Plan A, put 2888 into 2891, and hold 2888 as a vehicle?
As a vehicle. No, the relating clause is on 2888.
I'm sorry. Right.
But Representative Otto's bill, which the committee tentatively has decided not to handle in that form, they're going to be handling it in another form, another bill, could be a vehicle now, whether he would object to the use of his bill as a vehicle for this, I don't know.
I would doubt it.
And then we have a couple Administration of Justice bills, including this sort of omnibus one, so probably it could go in there.
That's fine. It's not something you're very aware of. I've been tracking this as a probable vehicle, and I'm not burning for it.
If you have no objection, I'd like to handle it that way.
That's
then.
Fine.
And we can confer later about scheduling and consideration of any subcommittee. Anything further than on either one of these two bills? Anything else from the committee? Okay, is there a motion on 2891?
Mr. Chairman, I'm clear on 2891 then whether we are adopting the Council on Court Procedures position on third-party practice or whether I missed that portion of the subcommittee which dealt with it, and I was unaware that they had amended it. And so you asked that question a while ago, and there was silence around the table here.
Well, I asked whether the committee wished to move to reinstate the Council's promulgated rule, which has been reversed by the amendment in subcommittee to 2891.
Okay.
During such motion, I took it then that the committee was accepting subcommittee's reversal of that council obligation.
I guess I need to understand what the subcommittee did, so I know what's being
reversed. The Council on Court Procedures wanted to change existing Rule 22C, which says file your third-party complaint within 10 days of filing the original answer. Mm-hmm. They wanted to change it so 90 days after the original service of the complaint, period. Subcommittee 2 voted just to delete the rule change and leave Rule 22C as it is right now, 10 days after filing the answer. And that's where it's at right now, and so without reversing what Subcommittee 2 did, if you just vote on the bill right now and vote it out with a due pass, the Rule 22C rule change will not go into effect.
This gentleman is advocating that we go with
a rule change. And to do what Mr. Tate suggests, you would have to take affirmative action to put it back in the bill.
Further discussion?
I'm really just kind of hanging on a balance point on that one, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if there's any way to deal with everything but 22C for the moment.
Well, it could be addressed this way. The committee could report the bill as recommended by the subcommittee, reversing the council's promulgation on third-party practice. If the subcommittee wished to readdress that question, it could then, if it decided differently, that is to accept the council's promulgation, it could send us through another vehicle a bill making the change which the council has promulgated, simply doing it as a matter of statutory change.
Who else is here from that subcommittee? Representative Courtney? Can you offer, was it a unanimous decision by the subcommittee that was present?
I don't know.
Do you remember?
I believe it was.
I don't recall any strenuous objection to that deletion.
Okay. bring this bill up for, that I...
Subcommittee 2 will have sort of omnibus 2 on its way. It's the one that was sent out for re-engrossment and coming back, and I think it certainly brought enough to put the rule change back in.
How do we handle it? My suggestion would be to report the bill as recommended by the subcommittee. If the subcommittee wishes, in view of the council's presentation, to readdress the question in the context of other issues before it, dealing with procedure a bit later, it's still open for the subcommittee to report a different recommendation in the form of a bill simply making that change.
As long as that, you know, if the proponents of the council's position are willing to carry it along and come back to the subcommittee for that, I'm just afraid if we send it out now, we'll never think of it again.
Well, I'll have Mr. Hall make a note to address the issue to the, or to bring the issue up and determine if the subcommittee would like to
reconsider,
to take further, to consider the issue further.
Okay.
And I presume that Mr. Olson at least would be available to come in if it were not convenient for a member of the council itself to be here.
All right.
And I think that bill will be 2632.
Is there a motion on 2891 as amended?
Motion.
Representative Courtney moves House Bill 2891 as amended be reported with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call roll.
Excuse me, will that need engrossment? There really hasn't been anything with...
I don't think so. The only, it'll have to be amended to put in the different effect. Let's see. There'll have to be an amendment that will, and I don't have it drafted yet, but it'll say the rule change to 22C is not effective or whatever.
Yeah, that's the most.
Aye.
Hill? Miller?
Aye. Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Mr. Porter? I've had Representative Burroughs remind me a number of times that judiciary bills come down unanimously, but we have never availed ourselves of the consent calendar. My explanation to her has been that we thought a number of things that come out of here unanimously may nonetheless require some explanation or questioning on the floor. I'm wondering if this is the kind of bill that ought to go on the consent calendar.
I think it's somewhat more substantial than what's... I don't think there's likely to be any member or opposition, but I'm a little uncomfortable putting a bill like that on consent calendar.
Okay.
Chair moves House Bill 2188 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call roll.
Martin?
Yes.
Miller?
Aye.
Skibera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
2399. This bill was sponsored by Representative Anderson at the request of the Oregon State Home Builders Association. Right now, under present law, a contractor or subcontractor or supplier must send a notice of right to lien. Get my notes here. This has to send a notice of right to lien to a residential homeowner only, not to a commercial property owner. And but for commercial projects, those same people have to send a different kind of notice of right to lien to a mortgagee. In other words, if you're a supplier, material supplier, and you're providing materials to a residence which also has a mortgage on it, you have to send out two different pieces of paper, both for the same purpose. One to the owner, called a notice of right to lien, and a slightly different one to a mortgagee. I think it's called a notice of right to lien, but in any case, it's the function is to inform the mortgagee that you're extending credit and could be claiming a lien on the property if you're not paid. It's, as I understand it, it's something of a historical accident that the two forms of notice are different. They contain the same information, but one is statutorily prescribed in the exact form and the other one is slightly different. This bill would simply allow the subcontractor or supplier to follow the same form of notice that is presently required for residential owners and use that same form of notice in sending it to mortgagees on all projects, both commercial and residential. Otherwise, it doesn't change the requirement of sending notice. It simply allows them to use the same piece of paper and, I suppose, Xerox it and send it to the send one to the mortgagee and one to the property owner. Then there's also an amendment which has been distributed, which has nothing to do with this bill, but it does relate to construction liens. At present, a party against whom a construction lien has been filed can discharge the lien by either filing a bond, which is what happens in most cases, or by filing depositing with the county treasurer an amount equal to 150% of the amount claimed under the lien. Most people, as I say, use the bond, but in a few cases, particularly some very large liens, property owners use this latter technique because the law also says that they get interest on the money that they deposit with the county treasurer during the pendant until they get the lien discharged or until it's litigated. We had some calls from some judges expressing concern that when this happens, the county, it maybe is investing it and making a whole lot of interest on it, but turns around and pays relatively little interest to the party who posted the money. And so all this amendment, LC 2399-1, would do is add language to the end of a line. The line says, the court in which any proceeding to foreclose a lien may be brought may, upon notice and upon motion by the person who makes the deposit, and so forth, order the money invested, and it would add this language, in such manner as the court may direct. So in other words, the court could direct the county treasurer to establish a separate Columbia Daily fund account or whatever. This one example that was given was of $1 million bond or amount that was paid in. And so it would simply clarify the court's ability to make the county treasurer establish a separate account if the court thought it was appropriate. The subcommittee approved this change. They also suggested changing treasurer of the county to state court administrator, and they voted on that, or trial court clerk. I've since checked with the state court administrator, with Judge Crookham and legislative counsel, and they all agree that it really shouldn't be changed. It should remain treasurer of the county because a property owner can do this, can give this money over to discharge the lien even before any lien foreclosure suit is filed or whatever. The whole thing can be totally extrajudicial. In fact, in many cases will be. This money, this deposit will be turned over before any foreclosure suit is filed. And for this reason, Betsy Belshaw didn't really want it to go in the trial court system because there's no lawsuit yet. And so my recommendation would be to amend, to take out the amendment by Subcommittee 2 that would have changed treasurer of the county, where it appears twice in here, to state court administrator, and just leave it as it is, as treasurer of the county.
Chair, would someone move? Is there objection? Doc.
Paul was the one that docked.
Now, the other amendments, well, including that portion, were adopted by the subcommittee.
Yes.
All right.
Blue House Bill 20.
Is it clear to you House Bill 2399?
That is re-amended.
As amended.
To the floor.
Is there further discussion?
Yes, I have a question for Representative Kirk. The next bill is coming up. 2639 is the AGC bill to change the number of days. My file doesn't indicate that I understood that they successfully came to a compromise on an 8-day, not including weekends and holiday decision.
Right. Right.
Okay, then if that is the policy that we're about to take up in 2639, I'd call your attention then to the current bill, 2399, and looking at subsection 3 at line 17, we have the 10-day notice in there of this document. I wonder if that is in effect the same document.
Well, I think that is amended. That same section of ORS
is going to be amended by the next bill.
Let me see here. Yeah.
87021.
Yeah, so that you can sort of ignore it a little bit, and the next bill will pick it up, and as I understand it, there's no problem with that. If both bills become law, both changes will be made in the statute.
Is it 87021?
Yes.
87025.
Right, it's in section 3 of House Bill 2639.
Page 3.
Okay.
So all right, we'll pick it up.
All right.
Okay, for the discussion. Call roll.
Gordon?
Yes.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
2639. This bill is a Judiciary Committee bill at the request of the Associated General Contractors, and it would simply pick the three places in the law right now where a subcontractor or supplier has to send a notice of right to lien to a property owner, and I believe it picks up the one for the mortgagee, which we just discussed. In those three places, the present requirement is that this notice has to be sent within 10 days after the goods or labor for which the lien is claimed were delivered. In other words, you have 10 days. Your lien will only cover anything that happened in the prior 10 days. The amendment is to change it from 10 days to 8 days, this is in quotes now, 8 days not including Saturdays and holidays as defined at ORS 187.010. Sunday is defined as a holiday at that section, so basically it's Saturdays, Sundays, and legal holidays. The purpose for this change was to get at the situation when there's a three-day weekend and the party who wants to send out this notice of lien or potential lien runs out of time to get it all, get everything together. So if this amendment is accepted on a three-day weekend, you would essentially be allowing 12 calendar days. And on a, if there were no intervening three-day weekend, you'd be essentially allowing 11 calendar days instead of the present 10 calendar days. Since the subcommittee acted on this, I spoke to Mr. Kalinowski again. I raised the concern that if you use the language 8 days not including Saturdays and holidays as defined at 187.010, a property owner may look at that and say, oh, Sundays aren't included. And I asked him what would he think of language such as 8 days not including Saturdays, Sundays, and other holidays as defined at 187.010. And he said he had no problem with that. And I leave it to the, it's just a question of wording, whichever way the committee.
I think there would be a potential for some confusion, perhaps. The chair would move the adoption of the amendment
proposed by Mr. Hall.
Yeah, and appearing at the bottom of the status report sheet. Is there objection? Further discussion of the bill as amended?
Mr. Chairman, I want to point out that in the continuing saga of those people who are concerned about paying a lien twice, notwithstanding the fact that this is an industry compromise, I think really coming to the subcommittee and with the groups coalesced around this as a solution on this problem, this is a matter that's been brought to us by AGC for several sessions in a row, and this is the first time it's gotten some attention. You have, in effect, lengthened from 10 days to potentially 11 or 12 days, the period of time within which a homeowner will gain notice that someone has performed lienable work or provided lienable materials on their premises, and that they may have, in that 11 or 12 days, already paid the general contractor who has failed to pay the sub. So you're actually expanding the amount of time within which they can fall into the pay-twice trap. And the only thing I have to offset that is that we hope that the suggestions on House Bill 2146 that are working their way up through subcommittee to the full committee, which is the pay-twice bill, will provide at the front end greater notice of these types of pitfalls to the consumer at the earliest possible date. And so there are many, many people who will militate in the other direction. Senator Yee was in to see me today in behalf of one of her constituents who would militate toward 0 days. She wants that notice of delivery and so forth handed to the person at the time the concrete mixer arrives on the site, which I explained was impractical under the circumstances. But we're expanding by a day or two something that some people would say ought to be contracted. And I'm going to support this as a compromise, but it is something that you ought to anticipate answering either amongst your constituents or someone working in this area. Is there a motion on the bill?
I'll move the bill.
Duke pass as moved. House Bill 2639 as amended to the floor of the Duke pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Yes.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Lyons?
Aye.
Please report.
Mr. Chairman, I would offer to carry both of those lien bills if you'd like, and the latter one, maybe not, but I think the first one certainly a consent calendar, and frankly, since we're unanimous on it, I put them both in the consent calendar.
What's a consent calendar?
Okay, is there objection to the previous two bills?
Well, do you want to do that?
I'll explain it just the way I just explained it. That's the only potential objection I would know of why anybody would oppose that, and I will explain, if I carry it, what that objection might be. Put on the regular calendar, do you want?
Let's leave it.
Let's leave it.
Okay.
This bill is a variety of representatives of the Department of Bureau Federation, and the original printed bill is no longer what the bill is about. It's that was deleted, and the amendments simply, under present law, a grain producer has a lien in the grain that's turned over to a buyer, a wholesaler. The lien is automatic for 90 days and then can be extended by filing a particular form of notice with the Secretary of State's office. The definition of grain under the present law does not include seed grains. Seed grains and vegetable grains. This bill, as amended, would simply add to the definition of grain under the existing grain producer's lien, seed grains and vegetable grain. Otherwise, it wouldn't change the procedures and wouldn't change the type of lien that is created.
The amendments were adopted in subcommittee?
Yes.
I would move House Bill 2740 as amended to the floor do pass.
So Courtney moves House Bill 2740 is amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call the roll.
Courtney?
Yes.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Lyons?
Aye.
2252.
This bill comes from the Attorney General's Office, Department of Justice, and it would, right now, the Oregon EPA is a little unclear, but when taken together with the rules of the appellate courts, basically agencies are required to pay for the cost of transcription of a hearing before an agency if the party appearing before the agency appeals the agency's decision. The bill, as amended, would change all that, and instead it would require the appellant from an agency decision in an administrative appeal to designate the parts of the record on appeal, well, that's required already, to pay for the cost of transcription of those parts of the record before the agency, which the appellant wants to have before the Court of Appeals. These amendments were at the suggestion of Thousand Friends of Oregon. In fact, they drafted them, and they were acceptable to the Attorney General's office. So the bill is originally written, I think, would have been broader and would have made the appellant pay for the entire cost of transcription of the entire record. The amendments would limit it, so the appellant would only have to pay for the portions of the record designated by the appellant from the agency decision.
Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, move the floor do pass as amended.
Representative Courtney moves House Bill 2252 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Courtney?
Yes.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
And the final bill, 2254.
This bill also comes from the Department of Justice. At present, the state agencies may be a co-respondent in a number of cases which are appealed, in which the state agency really has no particular interest in the outcome of the thing they're a respondent, either because they have to be or whatever. And right now, the if the respondents lose on appeal, the court will order costs and disbursements to the appellant to be borne by the respondents. Under present law, and I don't think it's statutory, I think it's just sort of common law principles, those costs are jointly and severally borne by all respondents, and as a practical matter, that means that the appellant, the winning appellant, always goes to the state and gets the entire amount from the state, even though the state was not the main respondent, not the main party in it. This bill would simply require the court, when it awards costs and disbursements to a successful party on an appeal from an agency action, to apportion costs and disbursements equally between all the co-respondents. So if the state is the sole respondent, the state will bear the full costs and disbursements, but if someone else is a co-respondent with the state, it'll be apportioned equally between them, and the state will only have to bear one half of the cost in that case.
Your motion to the floor. Representative Courtney, House Bill 2254, and reported with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? All right.
Courtney?
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Smith? Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye. Once again, Mr. Chairman, I think 2252 and 54 are candidates for consent calendar. The last two bills are basically just procedural matters. Representative Smith moves that House Bills 2252 and 54 be reported with the recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Is there an objection to that change in the committee's action?
What's consent calendar?
Well, the effect of placing it on the consent calendar there is a procedure by which it can be removed from the consent calendar upon the objection of, I believe it's
two members?
Three?
Five.
If it remains on the consent calendar, then it is taken on the floor on the basis of a 2-minute presentation by the floor manager, followed immediately by a vote. And I think the only motions that would apply to it would be, I think we refer indefinite postponement. But there is no debate on the floor.
Why would you want to do this, Representative?
First of all, it speeds up the process on the floor. It's usually done on bills that come unanimously out of committee, which would be of little controversy, and it expedites the floor session. And I think we have more and more bills like this, particularly ones I've watched people as we've had 5 and 6 and 7 of our bills on the floor down there that we passed out unanimously. And pretty soon they become a bit cantankerous on the floor just because the Judiciary Committee is doing it to them, but the bills get unanimous decisions on the floor. These are very small policy decisions about which most members would have no objection and simply need an explanation of what they are before they pass, and they don't need a debate. I just think they're candidates for a quick disposal on the floor, and if someone disagrees, all they have to do is get any other four members to join them, and it's removed from the consent calendar and put on the third reading calendar. But I think we ought to be looking for more candidates like that, where we're just making simple changes.
The objection to Representative Smith's motion.
Okay.
Order.
This time we'll now begin our public hearing on the first of a group of bills that will bring before the committee a variety of issues dealing with the correction system beyond the point of the conviction of a criminal defendant. And we're going to begin with the interim judiciary bill relating to the creation of a judicial matrix sentencing system. Let's start with Mr. Griffith.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Stephen L. Griffith. I am a lawyer and associate at the law firm of Stoll, Reeves, Foley, Fraser, and Wise. My practice is in civil litigation. This last year, I was on the interim task force, which looked at the system, the procedure for imposition of criminal sentences, and particularly what happens when the decision is made, or the possible decision is made, to incarcerate the defendant. I'm here to speak on House Bill 2087 on its behalf. 2087 is somewhat like an opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States, in that each of the sections or elements of that bill represents decision or a recommendation of a majority of the members of our task force, but I'm not sure that any one member of the task force would have stated that he or she was an advocate for all of the sections. The purpose of the task force and the purpose of this bill was twofold. First of all, to instill a greater degree of